Greetings, Metropolitans. You're listening to episode 3 of Flights and Tights, a Superman movie podcast. I'm Jessica Plummer.
And I'm Rebecca Goldberg.
Today we're going to be talking about 1983's Superman 3, starring Christopher Reeve, Richard Pryor, Robert Vaughn, and Annette O'Toole, and directed by our old friend Richard Lester.
Before we get started, announcement time. We are now on iTunes/Apple Podcasts/the podcatcher of your choice. So much more convenient probably than SoundCloud for listening on the go. So please subscribe to us there on Apple Podcasts. And if you would like to, please leave us a review and a rating, maybe 5 stars.
Or 6.
Or 6 if you can. And it'll help other people find us.
So let's talk about what happens in Superman 3. Which I had never seen before this, and I don't think you had either, right, Rebecca?
I saw it, I think, a long time ago, but remembered almost nothing about it. So.
Well, it's very memorable, as we're about to see. So this is mainly actually a Richard Pryor movie that Superman happens to be in. He plays Gus Gorman, this sort of idiot savant computer programmer with a flimsy moral compass, who gets caught embezzling via what's basically an early form of hacking by his boss, Ross Webster, a tycoon with no moral compass at all. Webster gets Gus to hack into a weather satellite and destroy Columbia's coffee crop because they've refused to do business on his terms, and because obviously that's what weather satellites do. Completely unrelatedly, Clark goes back to Smallville to write an extremely boring article about attending his own high school reunion, and rekindles a tentative romantic relationship with Lana Lang, the girl he had a crush on as a teen, who is now divorced with a young son. He does pause to save Columbia, which pisses off Webster, who orders Gus to make synthetic kryptonite. Gus can't figure out one of the elements, so he replaces it with tar and makes up an excuse to give it to Superman. The synthetic kryptonite doesn't kill Superman, but it has basically the same effect as red kryptonite on Smallville or black kryptonite in the comics, and makes him evil. He spends a while engaging in random, silly acts of destruction and vandalism, like he straightens out the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he blows out the Olympic flame, and it's all very wacky. Meanwhile, Webster is trying to get control of the world's oil supply, so he has his girlfriend slash mall slash quote-unquote psychic nutritionist, which I legitimately loved, Lorelei, seduce Superman into helping them. Finally, Clark's good side manifests itself again, and he splits into two separate beings, evil Superman and good but still superpowered Clark. They fight until Clark manages to choke Superman to, I guess, death, at which point Superman disappears, and Clark flies off to confront the bad guys. Webster, his evil sister Vera, and Lorelei and Gus, who are both kind of Team Superman now, lure Clark out to Glen Canyon, where Webster has built a supercomputer for Gus that's loaded up with all these defense systems. Webster and Vera nearly kill Clark with a kryptonite ray, but Gus has an attack of conscience and destroys it. So the computer becomes self-aware, sure, attacks everyone, and turns Vera into a cyborg, because why not? Clark manages to take it out with boiling acid and arrest everyone but Gus, who mugs for the camera a bit before walking off into the sunset. Clark then returns to Metropolis, where Lana has moved with her son, just in time for Lois to get back from assignment in Bermuda and be vaguely jealous of her. The end.
And we should clarify that, believe it or not, this is a very streamlined version of the plot. It cuts out a ton of slapstick and a lot of scenes that don't go anywhere, and also what they thought computers were in 1983. So we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Yeah. So this, as I said, this is kind of a Richard Pryor movie that Superman is also in. Or maybe a better way to put it would be that it's a Richard Pryor movie and then also a very short Superman movie edited in. And then also at the end, it's like a B-movie about attacks by evil computers.
Yeah, it's all very Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah. And then somewhere in there, there's even a tiny little movie about a couple that goes on a very unpleasant vacation. I checked the time because, you know, Donner did us so wrong that I keep an eye on the timestamp of everything happening in these movies. And it takes 40 minutes for Richard Pryor's character, Gus, to interact with Clark. And that's only because for some reason they're like, Gus, you have to go to a remote facility in order to hack the weather satellite. Because computer. And he's like, oh yeah, that makes sense because computer. So he winds up going to Smallville. And I was like, okay, finally something's going to happen here. But nothing does that has anything to do with the fact that he's in Superman's hometown. Like at one point,
no.
Clark accidentally opens a door into him and doesn't quite notice. And that's it. That's the extent of their interaction for that sequence.
They don't even really hang a lantern on the fact that it was a huge coincidence that he ends up in Smallville, which he didn't necessarily have to be there.
No.
It's just like fully happenstance.
It's just like they already had the one set.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm pretty sure that's what that was.
I mean, I think I would have even liked it more if Richard Pryor looked into the camera and was like, we couldn't afford to go to another location.
That would have actually been really charming.
I mean, Richard Pryor does enough meta jokes about the Superman franchise.
He really does.
It would have fit in, frankly.
Like, there's one point where they're like, all the bad guys are hot air ballooning in these weird little chairs. Like, it's like a little...
They're amazing.
I want one. It's like a little chair that you sit in and you have like a joystick and then there's a hot air balloon sticking out of it and you have to wear a white flight suit and giggle while you're riding it, apparently. They're all very happy to do it. As they're going like into the canyon where the supercomputer is, and Gus is like, absolutely not, I'm gonna ride this donkey down there, or a burro.
Which I understand.
Oh yeah, fair enough. But he goes, I guess I just don't believe a man can fly. And then the movie just kind of sits there for a minute like, did you get it? It's a Superman movie.
The actual most insane moment of that is after that at the end when Superman drops him off in the coal mine or whatever. And the guys are like, who are you? And he's like, you don't know me. I'm Superman's friend / sidekick or something. And then he pulls his shirt open, a la Clark pulling his shirt open to reveal the Superman costume. But in fiction, that makes no sense. He wouldn't know what that is. It's purely meta.
Right, because nobody in their universe has ever seen Clark transform into Superman, except for Lois, who doesn't remember it because of the amnesia kissing.
And she didn't even see him pull his shirt open because a chamber turned him into wearing a white shirt.
Right, yeah, the white shirt chamber. Yeah, no, I didn't even think about how that didn't make any sense in context. I just thought about how the joke was kind of awkward and went on a little bit too long.
Like most jokes in this movie.
Yeah.
I would argue.
I would say that for me, the worst interaction between these two entirely separate movies is when they finally, like, actually link up. They don't really link up. So Gus hacks the weather satellite and it causes hurricanes. And also it seems like maybe earthquakes in Colombia, which I have several objections to that. But yeah, so he causes all these problems in Colombia, and then he goes back to Webster. Like, we get a little bit of a time skip, and Webster and Vera and Lorelai are all celebrating, and Gus shows up, and he's like, oh, it went wrong, but it's not my fault. And Webster's like, what do you mean? And Gus is like, oh, you didn't hear that Superman went to Colombia and stopped all those problems? And like, at this point, from what the viewer has seen, Superman is completely unaware of the existence of any of these people or their machinations or any of this. Like, Superman has been occupying an entirely different movie about trying to get with the head cheerleader at the high school reunion.
I would say this is a problem in the first two movies as well. And I think
yes.
The problem in this movie is owed to them trying to sort of copy that formula. Like, Webster is very much poor man's Lex.
Yeah.
And Lorelai is very much poor man's Miss Tessmacher. So it feels like it's just a problem with the franchise that Superman never has an emotional connection with any of the villains ever.
That is true. I would actually argue that Lorelai is the rich man's Miss Tessmacher because I liked her a lot.
Although there was no payoff, the gag is that she's doing this like horrendous baby voice and then she's actually secretly smart. But I felt like there was no payoff to that. It was just sort of a gag.
Well, that's the Lester way, I think. I mean, there's a lot of setup that doesn't pay off. And there's a lot of like, wouldn't it be funny if a woman was really hot or wasn't? Or was hot, but was smart.
Wouldn't it be funny if a woman knew computers?
Haha, women. Like, that's the humor around Lorelai and Vera. Like, they're not especially complex characters. But I don't know, I found Vera kind of charming. Or, not Vera, she was abominable. Lorelai.
Yeah, no, I thought it was well performed, but oh boy, that Betty Boop voice. I was like, are we sure about this, guys? It's really rough.
But yeah, so then we have this long sequence of Richard Pryor describing everything that Superman did to save Columbia. And like, he puts a tablecloth on his shoulders and like runs around to demonstrate being Superman. And we do get like a couple of very, very brief cutaways to Superman, like flying or using his heat vision. But it's mostly like, hey, what would be more interesting to watch? Superman performing amazing feats that outperform nature, or Richard Pryor wearing a pink tablecloth on his shoulders and enthusiastically describing something? And like, not to insult Richard Pryor or his many fans, but Superman can fly and has laser eyes. Like, that's more cinematic. It just is, unless you're Richard Lester.
It's like a very third movie decision to save the money.
Oh, yeah. It was like, watching it, you're like, yeah, this is a budget thing. And like, there were definitely some budget things that I actually found really charming. Like, the incredibly fake Pisa setup with like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, where it's just two guys at a little stand and then what's clearly a cloth backdrop behind them. I was like, I love this. I love everything about this.
Yeah, the like, very early green screen of it was like,
yeah,
a real trip and a half.
It was so good because it was so bad. But the problem with the Gus describing what Superman did thing is that, first of all, it saps the energy out of what should be an amazing sequence. And second of all, it's a very weird way for those two completely separate storylines to come together. And like, they don't even really, because Clark doesn't realize this is anything but a natural weather occurrence. So he's like, okay, fix that. Going back to write my extremely boring story about my high school reunion.
I mean, the problem is that Clark never considers Webster even for a second.
No.
Really?
No.
Anyway, speaking of the high school reunion aspect, which is a fully separate movie that I kind of would have wanted to watch more of, maybe, mm-hmm. even though it's extremely cliche, that actually looked like they spent movie money on it. Like, it was like they tried to make it look like Kansas and it was idyllic, and
they filmed this in England.
Oh wow, really?
Which does not look like Kansas.
No,
I mean, some of it was clearly filmed in New York, but mostly it was filmed in England.
I mean, I it's very like, the excuse for Clark going is so flimsy. Like, who wants to read a story about a guy's high school reunion and like being in love with the cheerleader or whatever? And also, the movie never quite knows what to do with Brad. Was that his name? Like, the high school quarterback who's still in love with Lana, but is also an alcoholic or something.
Yeah, and that was also confusing because she has an ex-husband, but that's not him. Like, he's her high school boyfriend. I was like, why not just make him her ex-husband? Why does she have two exes, one of whom never shows up, and they all have really, they're literally named like Brad and Brian. I'm like, I don't know.
And didn't they say that the ex-husband also went to high school with them?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That was what really threw me off.
It's extremely confusing. And also, because I'm anal retentive, I did actually like sit down and work out the timeline here.
Oh, yeah.
Because this movie came out in 1983. It's supposed to be a 15-year reunion for the class of 65. So already we have a problem. Also, well, then I got to thinking about, I was like, well, okay, well, when did Clark actually graduate from high school? And then I thought, did he even graduate? Because Jonathan died and Clark immediately left for the North Pole and stayed there for 12 years.
Maybe Jonathan died like the day after his high school graduation.
No, he dies the day, like, they're at football practice.
Oh, that's the same day.
It's the same day. Not only that, but if it's football season, then it's fall.
Maybe he did a like a by-mail GED from the Fortress of Solitude.
He's like, well, I'm going to nail the poetry category because these crystals are loaded up with that. So, okay, fine. Like, let's accept that he did some kind of weird North Pole correspondence course. But whenever he left, that was 12 years before 1978. So the scene at football practice should have taken place in 1966. And it would have been the fall of 1966. So even if Clark was a senior in that scene, he would be class of 67, which I recognize as nitpicking, but that's who I am as a person.
I mean, we don't know for sure that the first movie takes place in 1978. In fact, if the movie takes place in 1976, then this makes perfect sense.
Right, then we're right on track. But one further protest, Christopher Reeve would have only been 13 in 1965.
I thought it sounded
it's
too
definitely
early.
Too early.
I didn't look up how old he
or
was.
Or he's a genius.
I don't think he is a
no,
genius.
No, he's definitely not. Like, he's not the dumbest Clark we've ever seen on screen, but nope. He's not the smartest one either.
Speaking of Smallville, I do want to talk about how good Annette O'Toole is in
this
movie.
She's adorable.
She plays Lana, and she's so charming. I mean, she's
yeah,
wonderful.
And Lana is, she can be a tough character because... Like, come on. Everybody wants Superman to end up with Lois, right? And this movie, except for the very end, did steer away from the active competition between Lois and Lana, which is good because I don't want to see that. But she feels like an interloper. And Annette O'Toole just gives her such a sweetness, which, yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. She doesn't even really feel like she's in a romantic storyline all the time. It's really just like, she's just trying to get her life together. Like, she's starring in her own little rom-com. She's, you know, gonna move to Metropolis to, like, get a new start. She's appreciative of help from Superman, which comes for some reason. She has a kid. Like, it feels like she likes Clark, but she's not, like, completely occupied with dating him or anything.
Yeah, she has other stuff going on.
Yeah, it felt like a modern sort of character.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was a certain element of, like, the movie is repeatedly like, poor Ricky, her son's name, which, excuse me, Lana's ex-husband is in fact former president Pete Ross, and her son is very awkwardly named Clark, and it's my favorite terrible fact in Superman canon.
I forgot they named their kid Clark. It's very awkward.
Very uncomfortable. See, this is why people don't like Lana, because she's weird. But not in this movie. But yeah, so her son in this is named Ricky, and there's a lot of like, oh, Ricky doesn't have a father. Ricky doesn't have a man in his life. What's Ricky gonna do? Maybe he's gonna grow up gay. They don't go that far.
Well, luckily Clark helps him cheat at bowling, so he won't grow up
gay.
Oh
my god. And also, I'm kind of like, where is his dad? Just like on the other side of Smallville, which is half a mile away. Like, show up a little, Ricky's dad.
That's why he sucks.
I didn't vote for Ricky's dad for president.
Not my Ricky's dad.
I mean, also I found Ricky intolerable, but...
Oh my god.
Oh my god. The scene where Superman's gone evil and... Lana and Ricky show up in Metropolis just in time to see Superman on a bender. And Ricky's like, Superman, what happened? This isn't you. Superman, don't fly away. I know you can hear me. Superman, Superman. And it goes on for like 10 minutes.
I was like, Superman's gonna murder you. Stop.
And I wouldn't blame him.
Read the room, Ricky.
God, Ricky. There's also the scene where... So Lana and Clark and Ricky and the dog, Buster, go on a picnic. And Lana, the first thing they say, they get to the field. And Lana's like, Ricky, don't go far. And he's like, I won't, Mom. And then the dog just like books it out of there. And Ricky's like, come back, Buster. And runs off after him, like straight into the next state, which Nebraska, I don't know. And Clark and Lana do not notice. They're just like sitting there in the grass, flirting their flirts, and eventually, like very, very slowly, Clark twigs that Buster is whining, and he looks around the field and he sees that Ricky apparently just fell unconscious, like apropos of nothing.
Did he run into something?
I think he tripped over a rock. There is definitely a rock there, and there's like a little bit of blood on his forehead later, but it's like, they did not make that clear. He's just lying there and some tractors are about to mow him down. And it's like, okay, first of all, this child was defeated by a rock. Second of all, why are they having a picnic in a field that's being mown? Like, what's wrong with them? Third, why doesn't Lana realize that her child is not around and in fact disobeyed the only thing she told him?
She's like, oh, blessed relief. Fourth, why does Clark change into Superman in the middle of Kansas and break the threshers? Just breaks them. He could have stopped him, but he breaks them.
Well, also, he could have just picked Ricky up. Like,
yes!
As a human man. Like, he could have just, like, waved at the guy and been like, stop, there's a child. Scoop. Like,
look at me, I'm wearing a red cape. You can't miss me.
I don't think he even had to change.
No, absolutely not. He could have just picked up the kid and gone away a little faster than a human could.
And I realized that, like, doing super feats as Superman in Smallville is to set up, like, when they give him the key to the city and then Richard Pryor shows up and gives him the weird kryptonite and so on and so forth. Like, it has a plot point. But I feel like if he'd just been like, hey, don't mow that child as Clark, they could have saved a little budget for when he, like, unravels a tornado in Columbia, and that would have been more exciting to watch.
That's a good point.
I also, speaking of the scene where they give him the key to the city, I was extremely upset that they casually dropped that Martha is dead.
Oh my god, I didn't even catch that.
Yes, at the reunion, someone was like, oh, I heard that your mom died. I'm so sorry. And he's like, yeah, it's a bummer. Yeah, Martha's dead. And
what the hell?
Right? And, like, watching them give him the key to the city, I was, like, genuinely really upset that Martha didn't get to see this.
I mean, they didn't have to kill her if they didn't want her in the movie. There could have been dialogue like, oh, I saw my mom earlier today. Like, we don't have to see her. It's fine.
Nope, she's dead.
That's so messed up. Now I'm upset.
I'm really upset. But someday she will be played by Annette O'Toole, and she will be great.
That's why they had to kill her, because Martha from the future can't meet Martha from the past.
Yeah,
it would cause
point.
A time paradox.
Solid, solid point.
Phew.
We should never have doubted you, Richard Lester.
He knew. He knew all along, even though she wasn't in the original pilot for Smallville, and they cast her again later. Fun fact.
Yeah. Go to Rebecca for all your Smallville deep cut knowledge.
Please don't go to me. Speaking of Superman getting the key to the city and getting infected by garbage kryptonite, should we talk about probably the most memorable thing about this movie, which is Clark fighting Superman in a junkyard?
It's a thing. It's a thing that happens, and it's a sequence.
I mean, here's the thing. It's not a terrible idea in a different movie. It's on the nose. But I think if they had ever made a movie where Clark had any thoughts, and those thoughts were like, should I be Superman or Clark Kent? What's the life that I deserve? Or blah, blah, blah. Then, like, I can see where you would end up with them fighting each other, and then it, like, metaphorically solves the problem. It would be bad writing, but it would be part of something.
Yeah, oh, I mean, and this is like, this is an old gimmick, right? Like,
of course.
This happens in comics all the time, where there's, like, either you have a dark clone, or
Bizarro.
Like, I mean, yeah, like, the Bizarro, or Superman Red and Superman Blue. Like, mm-hmm. Taking a character who lives a double life and splitting their psyche into two people and then making them fight. Very, very common. Like, there's a reason that I said that this is like black kryptonite in the comics,
mm-hmm.
because that does, in fact, split Supergirl into dark Supergirl and good Supergirl.
Actually, Smallville also used black kryptonite for this exact purpose.
Oh, I didn't get to that. I just got to the red kryptonite.
Yeah, it happens way later. It's very stupid. It also splits Lex into good Lex and bad Lex, as I recall.
Why would it affect Lex? He's not Kryptonian. That's
a good question, and I don't remember.
He should only be affected by reverse kryptonite.
I don't know if they called it black kryptonite. Look, I'll look it up on the Smallville Wiki later. I'm not going to bore our listeners with this. It's dumb anyway. That goes without saying.
But yeah, I see. Like, I agree with you that it's not necessarily a new idea, but it would have been a new idea for film. Like, that had never been done with a superhero movie before. And I think that, especially given the wider context of the movie, like, the fact that he's just lost the love of his life. Like, we have to imagine that the thing with Lois was pretty recently, and that's a function of his double life, that he can't be with her. He's gone home, maybe for the first time since his mother died. He's seen the girl that, you know, Clark Kent had a crush on when he didn't know he was anybody but Clark Kent. And all of a sudden, there's potential there. Like, there's a lot that could be going on for him emotionally if the Clark in these movies was ever allowed to have emotions. And, like, especially the shot that I thought was the most interesting was when it looks like evil Superman has won, and he takes, like, Clark is lying there unconscious, and Superman takes Clark's glasses off and crushes them in his hand. Like, that's a really interesting symbol. But all of that stuff, that's all stuff that Lester is neither interested in exploring, nor is he equipped to explore it, I don't think.
Also, there's no tension because, like, we don't think that Superman's going to just be evil now and kill Clark. It's still so fundamentally a kid's movie. Like, we didn't talk about this, but the opening sequence, the opening, like, main titles, is just a series of pratfalls.
Yeah, for some reason. They don't have it. Like, some of them are kind of tied into Lorelai, but...
ish?
Or Clark, but not really. It's just, like, stuff happening to people.
And it's just comedy. So it's, I mean, it feels like A Hard Day's Night or something similar. So it feels like that's the tone that's being introduced. It doesn't feel like it's going to end in Clark Kent dying in a thing that crushes cars.
No. To be fair, we never, like, I can't imagine a movie where we would think that Clark would go evil, which is why the end of Man of Steel was such a surprise.
That's true. It really defied our expectations.
But no, I think that that's a hard line to hit with any superhero, and Superman more than any, pretty much any other one.
That's fair.
But yeah, if there had been somebody else in that scene, like, if, you know, not that I wanted more Ricky, but if Superman was like, I'm going to kill you, you horrible child, and Clark was like, don't kill him, I want to bone his mom, then, like, there'd be something. I will say, even though it's an interesting idea that didn't really go anywhere and doesn't make much sense, and it's not a well-choreographed fight, either physically or cinematically, but as always, I think we have to give props to Christopher Reeve because he's fantastic.
He really enjoys playing bad Superman, which of course he does.
And I think, you know, like, has any Superman actor not gotten a kick out of that? They've all done a great job.
It's true.
Even Welling, who, bless his heart, is not going to win any best Superman contests.
I mean, he does really enjoy it. It's his second best work on the show after he has to play Lionel Luthor.
Again, contact Rebecca for questions.
This is not a Smallville podcast.
But yeah, no, I don't understand why his evil Superman has, like, a New York accent, but that's not important.
I think you know why. Because people from New York are all evil.
It's true. It's my dark secret. But not only is he having a lot of fun, but he really, like, almost to the point where, like, I kind of forgot they were the same actor because his physicality as pure Clark versus this, like, new character of evil Superman are so, it's so different.
He also has, like, a 5 o'clock shadow and, like, salt and peppery hair almost.
Yeah,
like,
he's older.
I feel like that's Reeve's real hair color maybe. Like, it's a little bit lighter than black.
Yeah.
But it's a stark difference, even though it's very subtle.
Can I tell you something?
Please.
I was kind of into it, and I was like, why am I into evil Superman? What does this say about me? Also, I thought it was pretty funny that evil Superman's costume is basically just the costume from Superman Returns.
Twist. It was Lester's vision all along.
Gasp.
We are only two episodes of this podcast away from talking about Superman Returns, so everybody needs gear up.
If only we had done this a bit earlier, we could have done a very short March Madness bracket to see which child was more annoying. Ricky or the kid in Superman Returns, whose name I forget.
I don't remember his name either. Jason? I think it's Jason. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think you're... No, because I was thinking James Marsden's character's name is Richard because he's totally named after Richard Donner.
Yes.
And maybe Richard Lester, but probably
maybe
just
he's
Richard
grown
Donner.
Up Ricky Lang.
What? Oh my god.
I think that timing works out age-wise.
How deep does the rabbit hole go?
Let's find out how old James Marsden is.
He's handsome years old.
That's true. Yeah, so he was 10 when this movie came out.
All right. There you go. There you go. We solved the mystery.
You're welcome.
Add it to Wikipedia, folks.
But don't worry about the fact that Lois and Clark have apparently not aged, but Ricky grew up into an adult man and was adopted by Perry White. Don't worry about it. No, Perry's his, like, uncle. Whatever. We'll get to it when we talk about Superman Returns. Anyway, you can tell how great this movie is by how little we're actually talking about.
There's just nothing to talk about. Like, there's really nothing. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, but so much of that is just, like, the awkward silence between half-jokes from Richard Pryor.
Yeah, he, like, gets dropped into scenes and is clearly improvising, and then everybody just has to sort of react to him, and then the scene just ends. And, yeah. Like, Richard Pryor is very good at what he does. I don't know if this is the best vehicle for him.
That's the thing. I feel like he was probably, like, really constrained by how, well, that it's a movie for children.
Completely.
Like, this is a guy who had to have a 5-second delay for the Oscars and SNL because he couldn't stop cursing. So there were probably a lot of wasted takes.
But I'm sure they were hilarious.
Oh, yeah. But, and like, I honestly don't blame him. I blame the editing.
Oh, completely. And also just, like, the tonal asymmetry. Right.
But it's editing's job to fix the pacing of a scene that's not working.
Completely. I did, like, if you're looking for a bad movie that talks about computers the way that they thought of computers in 1983, they do talk a lot about computers.
They do. It's a fun little time capsule. And I like, there is actually kind of a theme there, which I think is probably an accident. Or there's a repeated motif about how computers are unknowable and threatening and evil, which I think is more of a runner than a deliberate theme. But when you compare that to Clark going back to Smallville, and it's wonderful, and the girl he had a crush on in high school is totally into him now, and he gets the key to the city, and everything's great. There's a real, like, deliberate contrast between the bucolic past and the scary, scary, you know, robot lady led future.
Well, maybe it's like an episode of Black Mirror where everything's so great in Smallville because he's trapped in a simulation of some kind.
There you go.
I figured it out.
I mean, well, and even the fact that Lana is divorced is very like modernism.
For sure.
What can't it ruin?
I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention that Richard Pryor's initial scheme in this movie is referenced in Office Space, where he collects all of the half cents that the company doesn't pay its employees and then pays it all to himself and makes a lot of money. And it's a short part of this movie, but I think it's telling that it's like, oh, this guy is a master at technology for reasons that are never explained. And he uses it to like benefit in a way that's like he's shouldn't be entitled to, and then that's what gets him looped into the bad guys. Like, it's very much like technology is a tool of the evil capitalists, basically.
Yes, definitely. Well, think of, like, I mean, in general, Webster is super high tech. His office is entirely like silver and chrome.
Mm-hmm.
He has his weird little hot air balloon chair, and we could tell that no, Gus is virtuous because he won't ride in one and he takes a donkey.
But he is a master of computers and can make computers do literally anything.
But he doesn't really know what he's doing, which I think is like his saving grace. Like if he actually were confident and like really like knew what he was doing and didn't write his supercomputer plans on like the backs of receipts and stuff, then he would be evil. But because he's kind of like stumbling through it, he's redeemable, which like at the end, when the other three get arrested, even though Lorelai didn't really do anything.
She pressed two buttons.
Yeah, she pressed two buttons and she had consensual sex with Superman. Like, so she has to go to jail because she's a woman who had sex, which sure. I'm pretty sure is only the second time he's ever had sex. I mean, think about it. But Gus, he just, like, Superman just drops him off at that coal mine and is like, good luck, have a nice life. And, like, I get that Gus saved his life and he's grateful, but Gus also knowingly and willingly committed many crimes, like a lot of crimes.
I mean, first of all, to put a pin in this, I think it's funny that Clark had sex with Lorelai and then forgot about it because it was evil Clark. I feel like that's karma for when he made Lois forget about having sex with him.
Legit.
but what I think interesting, I totally see what you're saying about how Gus is sort of redeemed by his ignorance, but it also is so frustrating that he's an accidental genius who has sort of no agency about it. I think if he weren't so haphazard and whoopsie daisy about it, he would be maybe more interesting if he, like, knowingly used his knowledge for things. But he feels like he's never really on board with what Webster is doing. He doesn't really care about anything. And I have to feel like it's also related to, like, a racial aspect of, like, they would never write a black character who is smart and good at computers. And it's all, like, the way we meet him is in the unemployment office, and he's, like, sassing the lady at the unemployment office, and it all feels very racialized in a very odd way. And I think it kind of sets the character back by taking any agency away from him or any actual knowledge or driving of the story.
Well, he also, he doesn't really have anything that he wants for longer than the time it takes for that scene to end, right? So he wants to get his unemployment check, but doesn't particularly, like, he doesn't want to get out of unemployment, but he also doesn't seem really committed to not working, because then he immediately gets a job and he's working for the rest of the movie. He wants to get more money, but then once he gets looped into Webster's plans, he's not really gunning for more money. Like, a couple of times he says, what am I going to get out of this? And Webster's like, you're not going to go to jail is what you're going to get out of this. But eventually, when he does finally put his foot down and say, no, I want something out of this deal, and Webster says, what is it? He's like, I want you to build a supercomputer so I can do your evil bidding more effectively. Like, that comes out of nowhere? And wouldn't you think he'd just, like, want more money or to be king of Australia or to just, like, get the hell out of all this?
Well, it feels like it all plays into sort of the stereotypical laziness. Like, when he's in the unemployment office, he's trying to get more money than he's allotted. When he gets a job, he immediately tries to scam the company to make more money. And, like, he's not even so ambitious that he's going to keep that scam going. Like, he gets something like $50,000 from the half cent thing. And then he's like, great, that worked out. And then he's just trying to not get caught. I don't know. It's hard to imagine this character as a white character written the same way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he doesn't want anything because after he sort of achieves his small goal of making money with doing minimal work, he then becomes fully subservient to Webster for no particular reason.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a function of Richard Pryor being a much bigger name and a much more compelling screen presence, but he's a much more interesting character even without, like, the agency and the drive that we've just laid out. Like, Webster is nothing. He's a complete nonentity. Like you said, he's the poor man's Lex Luthor.
And his sister also is nothing.
Yeah.
Like, they're so useless.
Like, literally, Lorelai could be standing there with, like, two little signs in the shape of human heads that say evil man and evil woman, and that would do the same job.
Evil rich man and evil rich woman.
Yes, of course.
I'm honestly surprised it took as long as it does in the movie for the computer to become sentient and start attacking them.
I mean, in retrospect, yes. But I did not realize that's where we were headed.
Oh, me neither.
Because, yeah, that's like the last 20 minutes are a totally different movie that is about an evil computer.
Which I think would have been a better movie if it was about Richard Pryor trying to wrangle an evil computer with his mad hacking skills.
Well, and we're going to get to this, but the original treatment for this movie had Brainiac as the villain. And I think there's a movie that is not at all the original treatment, which is horrifying, and not this one, but there is a movie about Brainiac and Richard Pryor where, like, a hacker accidentally summons Brainiac from outer space and shit gets real.
And he doesn't know that he's being sort of controlled by an actual alien overlord.
I think that could be really interesting, although as I'm saying it, I'm realizing that it's kind of the plot of the Green Lantern movie, which was terrible. But still, I think we could do something. There's something there. We'll workshop it.
But I do love that idea, and I think doing, like, that would be a good use of Richard Pryor, too. Like, bouncing him off an evil genius robot alien computer.
Yeah, this could have been a better movie.
Anyway, the way Superman defeats the evil sentient computer is that he tricks it into being burned by acid because the machine didn't know it was in danger and didn't protect itself like an animal.
Yeah, they don't understand what computers are. Sometimes computers put tinfoil on a woman and then she has telekinesis.
Yep.
Didn't you know?
Also, one of my favorite visuals of the movie is when Superman comes to their evil computer base, they like arm like rockets to shoot at him through this canyon. And the visual from their point of view is like an 8-bit video game where you have to try to shoot Superman. It's like Duck Hunter, basically.
It's a side scroller.
Oh, my God.
It was created by Atari. I looked this up.
Oh, my God. Was it a real game?
No. But the visuals were created by Atari.
Oh my God, that's amazing. It's so funny. It makes no sense.
It was my favorite part, and like when it started, I was like, is this suddenly an episode of Clarissa Explains It All? Are we trying to get rid of Ferguson?
It does straight up look like that.
It's so good.
It's also just a very not useful way of trying to shoot somebody in real life.
Yeah, like, it's extremely stupid, and I loved it.
Oh my God,
like,
that's incredible.
Like, unironically loved it.
Oh my God, there was a side-scroller for the Atari 2600 that's even cheaper and crappier looking, because it's
Are you Googling Atari games?
No, I'm Googling Superman games.
All right. So, I did want to jump back real quick to talking about Lois.
Sure.
And Miss barely appearing in this movie.
Yes. But she has a tan when she comes back.
She does, which I thought was very charming. But yes. she's off in Bermuda on some, like, undercover assignment, which, like, I have to say, nobody wants to read about some rando going to his boring old high school reunion, but I do really like the idea that Lois goes after, like, these dangerous investigative pieces and Clark writes human interest. It's just that there's no interest in his human interest story, but, like, theoretically, I'm charmed by it.
Well, possibly the least realistic thing in this movie that contains a computer turning a woman into a cyborg is when Lois comes back and is like, I read your piece about the high school reunion. It was really good.
I choose to believe she was being very dryly sarcastic.
It seemed too genuine to me.
She's like, I took down several governments, but your little thing was good too.
I'm glad you had a crush on a lady.
It's like so boring.
Also, by the way, speaking of his crush on Lana, at the end of the movie he picks up a piece of coal and he turns it into a diamond, and then he goes to Lana and is like, Superman told me to give you this to make up for the fact that she had lost her previous ring. And then I was like, is Clark proposing or not? And I feel like even Lana didn't know.
Yeah, no one was totally clear. Like, definitely when Brad shows up drunkenly in Metropolis, even though he should be back in Smallville, he definitely thought Clark was proposing.
So did I, though. Was he?
I think it was just meant to evoke a proposal to show that, like, they have this romantic potential. But also the way he was like, Superman wanted me to give this to you. And she was like, oh, Superman did. Huh? And, like, she knows that he lives on a reporter's salary. Like, does she know he's Superman? Like, what?
I think that's a very generous read of the scene. I read her as being completely ignorant of it.
That's fair. That's fair. going back to Lois. So she's only in this movie briefly. The long-running story has been that it was because she was not getting along with the producers at that point because she felt that they had treated Richard Donner badly, which, I mean, they had. And she was Team Donner, so they cut her part down very severely. And also, they didn't bring Jane Hackman back for the same reason. Recently, people have said, no, everything was fine on the set, which is like, okay, well, no set ever has everything being fine, so sure. But I really enjoyed the bit at the opening scene at the planet when Clark's like, yeah, so I'm going to go back out to Smallville and write an article on my high school reunion. And Perry and Lois and Jimmy are like, we don't care about the words you're saying. And he's like, although I don't know if I'm going to fit in now that I'm a Metropolis sophisticate.
And I did like that.
Jimmy and Lois both stop what they're doing and look at him. And it's just, it's such a beautiful moment. And then Perry is like, well, I hate to lose one of my best reporters, but, it, you know, it is what it is. And Clark's like, thanks, Perry. And Perry's like, yeah, so bye, Lois, who is the person I was talking to.
I like to think that Clark was just testing them to see if they were listening to him at all.
He probably was. I like the idea of Clark Kent. Minor and harmless troll.
Yeah, I mean, how else would you amuse yourself when you're living that life?
It's true. It's very true. Also, at one point, they call Metropolis the Big Apricot, and that also made me really happy.
I mean, that's the best thing about Metropolis. It's called the Big Apricot.
Well, that and the monorail.
Of course.
All right. So, I think we could wrap it up because we're really avoiding talking about this movie. But I do have a question to close us out, and I want to hear your answer, but I would also like to hear our listeners' answers.
Ooh. Yes, please.
So if you had to choose, if you could only pick one kind of Superman movie, would you pick the Richard Donner style, super long, very ponderous, like self-important thematic slogs about how Clark is Jesus? Or do you want Lester's sort of aimless slapstick where, like, he's only even vaguely aware that Superman is in the movie?
For me, I think it's the former. Because if I'm watching a Superman movie, it's because I want to watch a Superman movie, not because I want to watch a movie. If I want to watch a movie, there's a lot of other options, including other Richard Lester movies I like more. And even though the Donner movies are, like, extremely boring, there's occasionally, like, moments that are super interesting or performances that are super interesting. And it's a little bit more followable than the Lester thing. So, I mean, that said, I think if you had to put the current Snyder movies into one of these categories, it would be the Donner category, and I hate them. But that's also because there aren't a lot of interesting ideas. But they are Superman movies, mm-hmm, rather than comedy vehicles that Superman also appears in. I don't know. I mean, the answer is neither, but that's not how you phrase the question.
No, you have to pick one. I think I would actually say Lester.
Interesting.
Because, so here's the thing about me. When people talk about something as if it's great and amazing and wonderful and perfect, and I think it's just okay, I start to dislike that thing really disproportionately. So the first Superman movie is fine. Like, it's not good, but it's fine. But I really resent it, because it has such a good reputation that I think is totally unwarranted. So I have, like, a totally unfair knee-jerk against that tone. Whereas, sure, I find Lester, if boring and pointless, they're both boring and pointless, but yes, Lester is, to me, much more inoffensive. So it's like, oh, some people are doing, like, mild pratfalls, and occasionally Superman is there. Yeah, I'll put that on in the background. Like, sure, fine, whatever. Although I will say that I do think that Donner, rather, actually has a vision for who Superman is and what kind of stories he wants to tell with Superman.
Yeah, exactly.
And I do respect that, even if his Superman is not my Superman. Like, the Salkins, the producers, and Lester, they have no vision for Superman. They're like, I don't know, how can we make money?
Right.
Well, the Salkins are like, how can we make money? And Lester is like, how can I make jokes?
Yeah, I think it's the respect for the material that I think puts Donner over the top for me, even though his take is not my take.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, viewers, please do let us know what you think via email, tweet, or smoke signal.
Email is flightsandtightspodcast@gmail.com. Twitter and Tumblr at flightstights.
My follow-up question is, if you had to pick a director, living or dead, to direct the Superman movie, who do you think would be your ideal choice?
I haven't given this serious thought for a while, but probably if you asked me 6 years ago, my immediate thought would be Brad Bird.
Mm, yeah.
Arguably, Brad Bird's already made a Superman movie. It's called The Iron Giant. But, I mean, you want somebody who loves the material and also has the kind of warmth and, like, nice take on the material that I want. Although, that said, I don't know if at this point I would want a middle-aged man who grew up with the Donner movies to do it, because I don't trust him.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. The entire thought journey you just went on is also my journey. I'm there with you.
I'm trying to think of a female director.
Who, I mean, I'd be perfectly fine with them just handing everything to Patty Jenkins. I liked Wonder Woman a lot.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I'm just trying to not make her my answer for everything because there's so many more people.
Right, that's the thing. If they wanted to give all of the DC movies to Patty Jenkins, Ava DuVernay, and Ryan Coogler, like, and Taika Waititi, I would have no complaints whatsoever.
I was going to say Ava DuVernay would make a great Superman movie.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd like to see all of their treatments first because I have a lot of feelings about Superman and I want to make sure they're going to get it right.
Well, I feel like I need to see Ava's New Gods and then we can talk.
Oh my God! I know. So excited!
I mean, that's, I think, a much better, like, that's such a good match.
Because she has that sort of weirdness,
mm-hmm.
that, like, colorful off-centeredness that's so Kirby.
Yeah, totally.
Speaking of things that are super weird and outer spacey.
Oh, good.
So I mentioned earlier that there was an original treatment for Superman 3, which was written by Ilya Salkind, who the producers are like a father-son team. Ilya's the son. It was put on the internet about 10 years ago.
God bless that person.
It's a real humdinger. I mean, I tell you what.
It's a roller coaster ride.
It bears absolutely no resemblance to the final product, except that Brainiac is the main villain, and I do think that's probably where the evil computer woman thing came from at the end.
Mm.
But yeah, it's all about,
and Lana,
like,
is there.
And Lana is there, but she doesn't do anything.
No.
But yeah, it's all about, like, Supergirl surviving the destruction of Krypton, and then she lands on Kalu, which is Brainiac's planet, and he raises her from infancy, but then he wants to have sex with her, and so she escapes to Earth, and she and Superman fall in love, and they're not related in this version, but it's all still very uncomfortable, and then there's a love triangle, and then Mr. Mixia's Piddalick shows up out of nowhere, and there's time travel, and, like, jousting.
They go back to feudal England.
It's amazing.
Like, including Perry, Jimmy, and Lana all go back to feudal England.
I'm so grateful that this movie was not made, but I'm also so grateful that this treatment exists. And we will link it in the show notes because we cannot do it justice. You just have to read it.
Oh, you know what else is in here that shows up in the movie? The idea that Superman loses control of his personality and becomes a jerk.
Yeah, yeah.
In the treatment, Brainiac has a machine that controls Superman's personality, which I don't know. There's a lot in the parentheses of this that are like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, he's like, marry me, Supergirl, or I will use this one toggle to make Superman kind of cranky. And she's like, no.
Ilya Salkind's example of what a jerk Superman would do is slap Perry White when asked to correct one of his own articles, which is so unreasonable.
It's a treat. So we'll have that linked in the show notes. You should definitely check it out.
It's absolutely worth a read. Yes, it's wild.
It's a very strange creation.
I also love that at the beginning he's like, facts to be checked with DC Comics, but clearly he didn't know that Supergirl was related to Superman, so I wonder what he would have said when DC was like, actually.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff in there. Like, there's a lot of parentheticals where he's like, in accordance with comics legend. And I'm like, you made all this up. Like,
yeah, like Supergirl becomes like a high school gym teacher.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
In accordance with comics legends. Like, what?
Specifically, a high school gym teacher in accordance with the comics, with legend, the legendary gym teacher. Anyway.
I'm glad it's not that movie. Truly.
I am also glad it's not that movie. And I'm doubly glad that Richard Donner didn't make that movie out of a fit of pique and then re-release it in 2006 so that we have to watch this movie twice.
That's a great point. The best thing about Superman 3 is that I only had to watch it once.
Amen. Well, thank you for listening. Again, you can now subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, and please leave a rating and review if you feel so inclined. Tune in next time when we will discuss the last Christopher Reeve Superman movie, Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and or SoundCloud at Flights Tights, and send us any comments, questions, arguments, opinions on Donner versus Lester, etc., at flightsandtightspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we're looking forward to your thoughts.
All right, thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Bye. It's a real humdinger. I mean, I tell you what.